Well, we're just going to chat informally so we can talk about teething and just about anything else. And actually, this is the kind of interview that I could do outside of the station. It doesn't have to be here. Oh, the quality is better. So I know it's disconcerting sometimes to come into a station and see these microphones and things like that.
I'm not feeling in my eye now. What is that?
Okay. I would be nervous, but this particular broadcast, it's a controlled broadcast, so I can take the material and I make a news report out of it, not unlike a column, I guess a daily column on books. There used to be a column in the New York Times Sunday Book Review. I think it was done by McDowell.
I remember that, and I wish they still had it.
Yeah, that was very nice.
It was very nice, and I wonder why they don't have it. And I wish I thought to ask him why, because he did the story on my book for the New York Times. And I should have asked. It was very good, and he would interview people if, you know, a new bestseller or something like that.
This week I'm having a Joseph Heller week.
Wow, wow.
All week long. Salute to Joseph Heller.
He's a nice man. I know him.
Do you know him?
I do.
So funny. I had no idea that his accent was so Coney Island-ish. So, well, how's it feel? I read the book. I enjoyed it thoroughly. I read this over vacation, and then they sent me the finished book. So how's it feel? You see a copy of your first book, published author, for the first time.
It's a great thrill. In fact, I think it's the most thrilling thing that in my life, except, I would say, for my little girl who was born in February. And it's even more thrilling, of course, to have them both being born the same year. But it's an enormous thrill, I think particularly with a book, more than any of the other writing or journalism that I've done, because you work on a book in a kind of subterranean, very private, quiet way for so long. And there's no feedback, really. There's very little feedback, at least. A few people read it, and that's it. But suddenly, when it becomes public, and you hear the response, and you see it in the bookstores, and the most wonderful thing, of course, is when a total stranger in an elevator or on the street or at a party comes up to you who's read it. You really feel such elation.
Well, this is your first fiction.
This is my first fiction, yes.
But you're certainly not a stranger to the craft of writing, though. You've had an extensive background. Tell us about that.
Writing has always been a compulsion with me, a happy compulsion, but it's always been there. When I was a little girl, I always wrote a great deal. I wrote letters, stories. When I went to Yale, I was in the first class of women at Yale. I wrote a lot, but always in literary criticism, and history of art, English literature. I never had the courage, strangely, to write for the Yale newspaper. I was always very hesitant about doing that, and I never took classes in creative writing. But I was encouraged there by the professor who was then the head of the undergraduate English department at Yale to become a writer. At that point, I desperately wanted to become an actress. And so, although I did a tremendous amount of writing, my time and energy was really split between writing and the Yale Dramat. I had a change of heart by the last year at Yale, and which occurred actually after I had lived in Paris for my junior year. And I'd missed writing so much, writing in English so much, I was doing writing in French, that I began to write very, very long letters. And I kept journals, as I always have, but really very, very voluminous journals and voluminous letters. And when I got back, I decided that I missed writing so much that I really did want to become a writer. And so I immediately after graduating from Yale, I was very lucky, and I got a job a month later writing for Women's Wear Daily, which was a fantastic experience, because I did a little bit of everything, and I was able to write a great deal on a lot of subjects. I covered fashion. By the second year, I was covering the New York designer collections for Women's Wear. I did a lot of interviews, feature stories, stories on art shows, writers. I traveled, and I worked for Women's Wear 5 years, and then went to the New York Times, where I wrote for the New York Times Magazine. And it was in the middle of my first year, at the Times, when the idea for Shadows and Light, my novel, gradually took shape.
Well, let's go back even further. Let's go back before Yale. Give me some idea of what life was like for you before you went into college. And I know you had some experiences abroad, haven't you?
I have. My mother's family is originally Italian. My mother's parents immigrated from Italy around the turn of the century, and her family went to settled in New Haven, Connecticut. And actually, it's very interesting, my grandfather, who unfortunately I never met because he died before I was born, was a contractor, and he worked on the building of Yale. So I've always had this Italian connection. And I was born in Oxford, in England. My father was a Rhodes Scholar, and I was born during his last year of studying there. And I went to Europe for the first time when I was 14 with my family. We went to Italy, we went to France, we went to England, and it had an incredible impression on me. I kept diaries, and I sensed then something which has continued to be true, which is that there is something about Europe, whether it is the history, the beautiful buildings, the architecture, the art, the slight feeling of decadence, that really makes my blood rush. And I love to write about Europe. That's one of the reasons why I think much of Shadows and Light is set in Europe, in Venice, in Greece, in France, because these places sing to me, and Europe sings to me. And I think I sensed this even when I was 14 or 15, and I continued to go. Then again, I went to Europe during my third year of Yale. I studied there, and then during that following summer, I worked in the public relations department of Christian Dior during the collections, and I spoke French every day. It was very odd for me at that point in my life to speak English at all. And so all of those experiences have contributed, I think, to my love of writing about place, and certainly to my love of writing about Europe, which is very much part of my book.
Well, in Shadows and Light, of course, Allegra is an artist and a painter, and very knowledgeable about the art world, working at the auction house the way she did. What sort of artistic background do you have that made you so knowledgeable about this, to be able to write about it in the way you did?
Well, I suppose I'm a very visual person, and very aware of detail in terms of rooms and objects. And always as a little girl, I would go with my parents to the Metropolitan Museum. And the history and the sort of secret life of objects and paintings have always been quite magical to me. When I was in college, I studied history of art and took many courses in 19th century painting and in Renaissance art, which is the Renaissance is a period that I love, and I hope one day to write a book set in the Renaissance. I got the idea of Allegra working at Sotheby's because I've always been fascinated, as I say, by this life of objects and by the work of people in an auction gallery. I think it's exciting work. It involves aesthetic judgments as well as very practical ones. But it, most importantly, it does involve judgment. And I think one of the crucial things about my heroine, Allegra Clayton, is that her judgment in work and in what she does at Sotheby's is extremely good. And she does her work with a great deal of authority. The problem comes in the other realm of her life, which is with relationships and particularly with men. And there her judgment is not so good. And part of the book, of course, is her journey through an extremely turbulent and somewhat masochistic relationship to the end of the book, where she does seem much more mature, wiser, and she has better judgment. So it seemed to me, beyond the fact that the idea and the world of auctions I found interesting, that the irony of the judgment question was very important and could resonate in the book.
Character I liked perhaps the best, but I think I forgot her name. I think it's Emily. Yeah, Emily.
Oh, Emily.
I liked her a lot. And I thought it was interesting the way you were able to switch from to a first-person imagery. Whenever Emily would speak, I guess she's writing, and she's writing, keeping a diary, as you did and have. So I thought that was a very nice touch. I liked the character of Emily a lot.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear that, because Emily is really, I think, just about my favorite character. In a sense, I think Emily made it possible for me to write the book. She is a very important voice. She is extremely acerbic, rather eccentric. She's an editor at Vogue who's extremely frustrated because she doesn't care very much about fashion and she wants to write. And she was born, and I remember it quite vividly, one hot July day as I was standing in the Gotham bookshop. And I had been thinking that I wanted one character who could voice some of my feelings about writing, because writing is such a crucial part of my own life, and who would keep a journal, and who could write letters. I love to write letters. I have a passion for letter writing and for keeping my journals. And I thought how wonderful it would be if I had a character like this who could add another dimension, another point of view to the book. And I think once Emily assumed her role in the book and point of views in the book began to multiply because of her sidelong glance all the time, that the book would become richer. And I think it is a device that works very well. And what I like about Emily as a character is that she, I think, grows from the first time you meet her to the end. When you first meet her, she's quite brittle. She's not particularly likable, I don't think.
No, I did not like her at the beginning.
But she's fascinating, and you do want to know more about her, and she's always got funny things to say about fashion and sex and men and New York society, and she's totally irreverent. So Emily is a character I think you get to like by the end of the book, but she always remains rather mysterious.
But Alexander did turn out to be the character. You had what appeared to be so many nice things about him in many respects, and yet it didn't turn out to be that way at all.
Well, I think Alexander always remains an elusive character. And at the beginning, yes, there is much that is likable about him, mostly because he is the man who is involved in Allegra's sexual awakening. And this is really such an intrinsic part of the book. And the fact that they have these rather delirious and sort of mouth-watering scenes together makes you, in a way, quite sympathetic to Alexander. He seems to care for her. This is a girl who is, I suppose you could say, using Jane Austen's words, beautiful, clever, and rich, but also painfully insecure. And he brings her out. And to the extent that he does this, he is likable. But I think you do also sense about Alexander, and I certainly meant you to sense, that there is something off about him from the very beginning. He is very ambitious. He is very menacing. Even when he's at his most sexy, there is something quite menacing about him. But he does have also good sides. You couldn't possibly have a male protagonist, as he is, who is such an important part of the book, totally intrinsic to the whole story of this obsession, of this obsessive love affair, without having him be at times charming and warm and sexy and caring to her. Everyone seems to see him differently.
Well, it's important in a mature novel, I think, to show people as complex individuals. In a mystery novel, one doesn't have to do that necessarily. You can take a cardboard figure, it doesn't matter that much. But if you're writing an ambitious novel, such as you've done, it's important to show the complexity of a person. You certainly did Shadows and Light skillfully, and for a first novel, I think that's an achievement.
Thank you, John.
I have to ask you some things about some of the legal aspects, because that is also something very interesting. Apparently, you had submitted the manuscript originally to Doubleday.
That's right.
What happened?
I had submitted the manuscript to Doubleday, in January of 1983, actually, and the book was scheduled to have been published by Doubleday this past March 84. And in September last year, there was a call from a lawyer representing a man I had been very briefly married to about 6 or 7 years ago, inquiring about the book. And he was told it was a novel, and that was the end of the conversation. He called again after the book had been excerpted in Cosmopolitan in last December, much more threateningly, and this time threatening a libel suit. Now, this was a lawyer who was not as far as my husband, who is a lawyer and a Peter Tufo and is a very brilliant lawyer, could tell. This lawyer was not even listed in the New York State Bar and was not with a big firm, or he had no firm. And Doubleday called me but never really discussed it with me and did not act upon it. And so on February 4th, I had just given birth to my little girl, Serena, and 2 days later I was called by Doubleday, and the letter was delivered to me in the hospital saying that the publication of the book, which was scheduled for March 23rd, was being postponed, and the shipment of the books was being halted because they had received this time an extremely threatening letter from this supposed lawyer threatening a libel suit. And, well, it was a terrible, agonizing period because I just had the baby. Doubleday behaved, I thought, in an extremely...
cowardly?
Yes, cowardly way, one that made me completely lose faith in Doubleday. It certainly made me profoundly disillusioned and disappointed with them. And I won't go into all the details, but by the end of this experience, I decided that I would rather not have them publish my book. And I would rather take the chance, buy the book back, buy the rights to my book back, and submit it to another publisher. I also felt disillusioned as a woman because I felt that if this had happened to a man, they would not have had this extremely panicked and rather hysterical reaction. But in my case, they did. I knew at that point that the book was going to be published in England, which it will be next January by Hodder and Stoughton. And so I decided to do that. It was a very risky decision, but it was the right decision, because I really felt that I could not be treated this way. And they had tried to extort money from me to make some very, very minor changes, and I refused to pay the money. By the end, when I came back and told them that I wanted the book...
Well, they had to reset it, didn't they?
Yes.
If they have to reset it, that is usually what the publishers do, if the writer makes any changes. Of course, in this particular case, they were asking you to make the changes. But frequently, a writer, after the books are set, will want to make changes in the manuscript or in the galleys, and then it costs them money, and they don't often go along with that.
Yes, but you see, in this case, Don, the book had already been physically published. You see, it hadn't been officially published, but it had been printed. It had been printed, 25,000 copies, I think, had been printed.
All 25,000?
I believe so, yes. And by the end of our discussions, when I finally met with them and with my agent, from William Morris, and told them that I wanted to withdraw the book from them and I did not want them to publish it, they were aghast and they urged me to reconsider. They begged me to. We had another meeting in which they also begged me to. But by that time, I really felt that my relationships there and with my editors and with my editor and with the other people at Doubleday had been so irreparably shattered that I couldn't see working with them. So we were able to withdraw the book. The next day, the moment the withdrawal was completed, I submitted it to Richard Snyder and Michael Korda at Simon & Schuster, and they bought it within days.
You did make some changes in the copy.
I made some very minor changes. The book went through the normal editorial process in the sense that Simon & Schuster felt adamantly that the book should have a new cover, a larger format, better quality paper, and a new typeface. So the book was going to be reset. And I thought, as long as I had the time, that I would incorporate changes, for example, that had been suggested by my English editor, some changes, minor additions and improvements that had been suggested by Michael Korda and Patricia Solomon, my editors at Simon & Schuster, as well as some very other minor changes which had been contemplated when I was at Doubleday. So I did make those changes. But whether or not I had made them or those changes, certainly there was no legal problem with the book. Simon & Schuster reviewed the case, and they said there was absolutely no legal problem. And Floyd Abrams, who is the eminent publishing lawyer, American publishing lawyer, saw no problem. So it was a very bizarre reaction that Doubleday had.
Was the character of Alexander based on your former husband?
Not at all. Not at all.
Or were there some incidents involving Alexander that paralleled incidences in your marital relationship?
Well, I think the man that I'd been briefly married to saw it that way. I certainly don't. And the character of Alexander was not at all based on my ex-husband. When I was writing the book, I did not picture him as this character. This is a very English character. He's very menacing. He's physically very tall, very gaunt. It's not the same thing, not the same character at all. And both the character of Alexander and the relationship between him and the heroine Allegra is also an invented relationship. It's, you know, Don, like all writers, and not just first novelists, of course you write about what you know, and you draw on what you know as well as your observations of other people, your fantasies, feelings that sort of well up inside you, and it all becomes transformed and takes shape in a very magical way into fiction. And I would never say that any character in my book is based on someone who is living today that I know.
Well, from a physical standpoint, you're certainly better off with Simon & Schuster because, as you know, Doubleday does its own printing and they mine the books extremely poorly. And they use cheap paper and a very cheap cover, you know, a dust jacket, and the books just don't look good, and, well, here you have cloth and boards, and I doubt if Doubleday would have used cloth at all.
Well, I don't think they
did. I don't know. I don't know how
they
printed it.
And they certainly did not put the care into the designing of the cover that Simon & Schuster did. Frank Metz at Simon & Schuster Design worked with me in designing the cover, and they've done a beautiful job. I think it's a very mysterious and sensual-looking cover, and I like the feeling of the paper and the typeface. I like the fact that my signature is embossed on the front under the jacket. And these little touches.
Yes.
It's a remarkable thing within the space of 6 months to be able to see your book in one incarnation and then in another, as if it were given a facelift, you know, and it makes you realize how important it is.
Because what happened to all those, 25,000 books that Doubleday had?
I suppose they've been pulped.
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy. It must have been agonizing to wait again after selling it and seeing the book and then having to wait for it to come out.
Oh, it was. It was agonizing. It was really the most terrible 6 weeks of my life. And it was particularly awful because it had coincided with the birth of my daughter. And you can imagine how terrible it was to be to learn this news in your bed at New York Hospital. It was a terrible episode, and I'm very glad to be out of it, and I'm very, very glad to be in my new home at Simon & Schuster. They're wonderful there. They're very driven. They're perfectionists. They know what they want, and it's an atmosphere that suits me very well.
Mm. Well, last question. It's one that Alfred Kazin, a very well-known literary critic, raised when I was talking to him a month or so ago. He didn't want to go into too much detail about it because he felt that he would get in trouble. But he is upset with some women writers. These are feminist writers, he says, who depict men in a very unfortunate and often degrading way, as brutes, as monsters, as evil. He says this is an offshoot of the feminist movement. And I was thinking about that, and I think that's true, that there have been a lot of books that cast a very bad light on men. I don't think that's the case in Shadows and Light. I know that Alexander turns out to be bad, but I do feel, and I want you to tell me about this, what you think, but I do feel that you do treat men in a respectful way.
Well, I hope so, because I do think it becomes very tiresome to depict men in a cardboard figure-like way and in a sort of hostile way. It is true that we have been through a turbulent time with women's liberation and a lot of upheaval because of that, But I agree that it's not fair to depict men that way, and I certainly hope that I haven't done that in Shadows and Light. I think there are some very supportive men in my book. The father, of course, who is dead, but he is still recalled in an extremely warm and supportive way. The other men in the book, it is only Alexander. I think partly because Alexander, of course, is associated with romance and with sex, and to a great extent, Allegra has been, her ideas of sex and romance are colored by literature, by the ideas of romance that many people tend to have, I think. It's sort of a time-honored idea that romance involves suffering. And to the extent that he is a very difficult man and sometimes extremely hard on her, she keeps on going back for more. Now, this is true of a lot of people, a lot of women, I think, more than men, but a lot of people in a lot of relationships, and I think that's why I've had such a wonderful response to this book and why it's doing so well. We've all known relationships where which have been uneven and which we've pursued even though we've known from the beginning that the relationship was doomed. Alexander does have a tremendous power on her, over her. Part of it is sexual, part of it is because he's an extremely authoritative character, and very worldly, very charming, and she's very insecure. But I would hope that the feeling that you get from reading Shadows and Light is not one that all men are evil, but that having gone through this relationship, one that is knitted together so much by sex, that by the end of the book, Allegra is a much wiser, more whole, more mature woman, and that the next relationship, and even romantic relationship, that she becomes involved in will be one that is much more rooted in loving kindness rather than this masochistic sense of the relationship with Alexander.
Well, in the words of Alice Adams, you know, men have feelings too.
That's right. And in fact, and I hope in my next novel, which I'm just beginning to work on now, I'm very much aware that I want to have a really wonderful and totally sympathetic man who is in fact done in by a very manipulative woman.
Uh-oh. I should ask you, since you're starting to work on your new novel, it's not a sequel. Allegra's
no,
coming
no.
back. How? What is the writing process like for you? Have you blocked out the book, or do you write kind of spontaneously, or what? How does it work?
Well, you have to have a schedule. You have to have a very strict schedule, at least I do. I don't believe that suddenly your subconscious kind of is taken over by inspiration and that suddenly you run to your typewriter and get it all down. I think you have to slog away every day. And it's only in doing that and being at the typewriter every day that you're able to produce something good. I go through a very uncomfortable gestation period. I hate not being immersed in a long writing project. I take a great many notes. I walk a lot. One of the things that I always do is carry paper and pens with me, especially when you're a mother and time is very precious. That can be while you're waiting for a soft-boiled egg to boil or you're walking your little girl up to the park. You never know when an idea is going to strike. And so I write these ideas down. I keep files. I start with one file, and then gradually as the book takes shape, I have a file for each major character, major scenes, a place. For example, I think my next book will have a country house in Scotland as a very important setting. So I'm beginning to do the research on that. And then I make an outline. I make an extremely detailed outline, which invariably I never follow, because a book, I think when you begin it, one of the excitements of a book is really not knowing exactly what's going to happen at the end. When I was in the middle of Shadows and Light, I did not know what would happen to Allegra at the end. I really wasn't sure that Emily was going to pull what she finally did on Allegra, and I won't say because I don't want to spoil the surprise. So much of the wonderful part of writing a book is that sense of surprise and the sense of unfolding. But beyond my files, my note-taking, and my research, the most important thing is to write every day. And I write from 8:30 to about 12:30. I take a break. I find that between 12:30 and 3 I don't work quite as well. I do other things. I return to the typewriter and I just keep working.
Do you have a nice quiet place to work?
I have a little room that used to be in my building, which used to be a very tiny maid's room, Dickensian maid's room, and it really is no bigger than a large closet. But I fixed it up, and it has enough room for books and my typewriter and a few filing cabinets. And it's very good because it's separate. And
it's not connected to your apartment?
No, it's on the main floor, which is very good, especially if you have a little girl, because you're not tempted all the time, which I know I would be, which I always am, to go running into a room and play with her or see what's wrong. So I can work quietly there, and that's essential.
It's almost like going to an office, a real office.
It's very important because having worked in offices before at Woman's Wear Daily and then at the New York Times, when I resigned from the Times after I'd received the advance to write Shadows and Light, I found it very difficult at first to get used to working at home, and I had to devise couple of things that would dupe me into thinking that I wasn't working at home, but that I was actually going to an office.
You know, Judith Rossner goes to a place, I think it's called the Writing Room.
Yes, at the library.
Because she is, what is it called?
I think it's called the Writer's Room at the library.
Writer's Room at the library.
And it's supposed to be wonderful. And you cannot have a phone there, and you have a typewriter, and a desk, and that's it. And you can't get any calls. It's very monastic. But
you're still near other people, and a lot of people like that feeling of being able to be near people, but without obviously having to be disturbed.
I think I actually would find that difficult. I like to be alone. And when I'm writing, I like to be surrounded by my favorite books, by my series of dictionaries, by my jars of pens and my stacks and stacks of stationery, because I write so many letters.
But writing at home, there's so many distractions.
But you see, in my separate room, there really aren't.
Right.
I have a separate telephone line there that almost no one knows, and I'm really quite private there, and that's what it takes, especially for a novel. And now that I'm beginning the new one, I find that it's even more crucial. I know this will be a longer book, and one that will cover a much longer time span, and it's going to require a lot of work and a lot of research and a lot of solitude.
You live in Manhattan.
I do.
Mm-hmm. Because you're a celebrity in your own building now, huh?
They're very curious. I think because of the sex scenes in my book seem to take people by surprise. They look at me and they think, now how could Miss Stanfill have written that? Miss Stanfield looks rather angelic. Well, the fact of the matter is that the self that writes is really quite a different self and much more daring. And in my building, I think they've all read the book. I know many of them have bought it and read it and liked it very, very much. But I think they are looking at me in a new light.
Well, sex scenes aren't that extreme. Did you read Trudy Gertler's book,
No.
Elbow and the Seducer?
No, I want to, though.
Oh, that's a marvelous book. You'll like that because it deals with the New York literary world. But I was telling Trudy that, 25 years ago, if you had written this book and tried to sell it, they would have charged you with being a pornographer.
That's
and
right.
She said, really? How wonderful.
That's great. Well, I think in terms of the sex in the book, it was important, at least I felt, that it not only be that the sex in the book reflect the relationship between Alexander and Allegra, that at times, especially at the beginning, that it be rapturous and mouth-watering, and that gradually it becomes much more tense, at times even spiteful. And by the end, in that scene in Crete, really quite vengeful. And I thought that was very important, that sex not just have one quality, that it not just be erotic, but that it go through all the transformations that I think sex does tend to go through within an extremely complex and somewhat enigmatic relationship.
Well, Francesca Stanfill was a wonderful first novel, and I'll be very anxious to read novel number 2 when it comes out.
Thank you very much, Don.
Thank you for coming in and talking to me.